They're like, I talked to this person. I talked to this person. I watched this YouTube video. I watched this YouTube video. This person said this. My parents say this. And what I tend to find is that the more confused people are, the more inputs they've got. And then we get internally confused because we start to think, I should be like this. We think that we believe something because the world sends us evidence. We don't realize that it is our belief that influences the experiment. This is why people will go to India to find themselves. Like, I don't know if y'all get this, but you're not in India. You're with you. Today, we are going to talk about the process of self-discovery. Now, this is challenging. So the question is, why is this so challenging? The answer is because we are complicated human beings. There's a problem, which is that here you are. And as you go through life, you have certain things that are on the inside, right? You have certain things like desires, goals. But then what happens is life sends you experiences. And then these experiences start shaping you, right? So this results in some degree of conditioning. And then the problem is we get conflicted because I want to make video games for a living. But then two things happen. One is I get bullied for being a gamer. And the second is my parents tell me you need to become a medical doctor because that's a real job. So this is the experience of life. So we go through life and we have certain internal drivers, right? So like you have a child who's relatively spontaneous, you know, is kind of joyous and likes to just explore things and like really enjoys this thing or that thing. So I'm a young boy who enjoys playing dress up and enjoys playing with dolls. And then people start bullying me. Or I'm a girl who likes math. And then even though I major in a STEM field, so science, technology, engineering, mathematics, I'm surrounded by people who may be a little bit misogynistic. And I like the subject, but I don't like the environment. So the basic problem in life is that we have this like thing inside us. And then as we move into the world kind of sends us different kinds of signals. And then we go through this process that we call learning, right? So I start to adjust who I am based on my environment. But then we get into a really tricky situation because if I adjust too much, if I lean into the conditioning of the people around me, then it gets confusing because is this really what I want? Or is this something that I've been conditioned to want? And even though I get sent all these signals from the outside, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this, I listen to those signals because they may lead to an avoidance of pain in some way. Or I trust these people, these are my parents, and they tell me to do this thing to make myself happy. But even though I sacrifice a lot and I listen to their advice, I don't end up happy. So then we get super confused because it's like, hold on a second, I don't know what to listen to. Like, that's the basic problem. Right? I don't know what the right answer is. Should I listen to this or should I listen to the outside world? How do I figure out what percentage of this to listen to? How do I incorporate the advice of everybody else? Is there some way to stitch these things together? And we get really confused. We don't know what's right and we don't know what's wrong. This gets further complicated by the fact that we oftentimes get traumatized. So the other huge problem with self-discovery or knowing what we want and why self-discovery is important is because a lot of what we learn in life is not intentional. See, when I learn a lesson, I don't choose to learn that lesson. The lesson gets learned automatically. So we see this a lot with like masking behaviors for neurodiversity. So people learn early on like, oh, like this is, I can't be like this. But you don't choose to learn it. And so there's all kinds of like shaping that happens to the human brain, the human body, the mind, that is not our choice. And sometimes that learning is maladaptive. So a great example of this is like hyperarousal in cases of trauma. So when you work with like a veteran who's gone to a war, and there are things like explosions and bullets firing and things like that, guns shooting, the nervous system wires to be hypervigilant to loud noises because this is a sign of danger. And then I leave the combat zone. I come back to the United States, assuming I'm from the U.S. So this is just where I grew up and where I worked with veterans. So I come back to my home country and then all kinds of benign things like a car slamming the brakes or a door slamming shut or someone yelling or someone throwing a, a can can trigger this hyper arousal. And so then I get super confused. I don't know what I want anymore. I don't know who I am anymore. I see this also with like content creators, where we work with a lot of content creators, and like as they start looking at all these analytics and you develop this personal profile, you lose sight of who you are. I also see this with people from like foreign diasporas, right? So like Indian people, Korean people. I'm sure this is true of American people who move to other places, where like you're not sure, like, is do I live my culture? Do I adopt this other culture? So we get super confused. We don't know what we want. We want one thing. The world tells us to want something else. We learn all these lessons without really like thinking about what we're learning or what impact it has, right? So life sort of goes into the document of our brain, changes it from read only to edit mode, and then just puts in whatever random crap it wants to. We don't get to write our programming. So today we're going to talk to y'all about how to undo this process, how to discover what you want, how to understand what gets in the way of discovering who you truly are, what amount of this is maladaptations and what amount of this is healthy adaptation, how to figure out whether a conclusion in your mind is right or wrong. So this becomes very important if you're a doomer, black-pilled, whatever, forever alone, where we form all these conclusions about ourselves. I don't know if y'all watched our video about male type anxiety. Absolutely applies to women as well. But this is what's so tragic about particular some of these things, is that we don't realize we think that we believe something because the world sends us evidence. We don't realize that it is our belief that influences the experiment. So I see this a lot with sort of the alphas and red pillars that I work with, that they think that relationships are transactional and women are only looking for one thing and they just want men for their money or whatever. And then they approach a relationship in a transactional way. This is what they believe. And then all of the women who are not interested in transactional relationships will leave. And all of the women who are all for transactional relationships will stay. And so this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So today we're going to talk about how to bypass all of this crap. And the first thing that we're going to talk about is obstacles to self-discovery. So what do you want? I don't know, Dr. K. I don't know what I want. I'm so confused. Okay, cool. We're going to help you. Obstacle number one, numbness. So this is so simple and yet so important. So sometimes within us, we experience bad things, and bad things feel bad. So as a compensatory mechanism, what we do to make ourselves feel less bad is to numb ourselves. So if I don't like the music on the radio, I'm going to turn down the volume. Now, the problem is that when I numb myself, when I turn down the volume on my radio set or my whatever, my device, any signal gets suppressed. So this is what we know from sort of like neuroscience, right? So if we look at things like studies on hemispheric lateralization and trauma, studies on dissociation, when people get traumatized and they dissociate from the good and the bad. I feel numb inside. It's not just our brain can't selectively numb just the bad things and feel the good things. It numbs everything down. Now, there are some caveats to that. Like we can utilize certain psychological defense mechanisms to selectively suppress things. So there is some from a neuroscience perspective, it's one way. We know that psychologically, there's actually contrary evidence to that, where I can use a psychological defense mechanism to actually suppress a very particular part of myself. At the end of the day, though, here's the basic problem with numbness. So problem number one is that when we numb the good, when we numb the bad, we also numb the good. But there's this caveat of psychological defense mechanisms, which means we can numb the bad without numbing the good. Interesting enough. There is a shared problem with both of these things, though, is that when we numb something, it does not disappear. We just become oblivious to its action. So when someone is a narcissist, for example, and narcissism is oftentimes rooted in insecurity. I basically think it's always rooted in insecurity, but there are arguments against that. So let's say sometimes that's a very fair, scientifically valid statement to make. The problem is that the narcissist doesn't recognize their insecurity. And so the narcissist gets into trouble because now that I am numb to this insecurity, I'm not aware that it is a problem. I cannot fix it. So this becomes deterministic for my life. I will always remain insecure until I understand it's a problem. Okay? So the other thing that we know from studies on hemispheric lateralization, when I work with people with addictions, right? So addictions is a really, really, really good example of this. Is that we will use substances or video games or pornography or social media, take your pick, to numb our brain. And when we numb our brain, though, that part of the brain, even though we're not aware of it, it still activates. It's still active and exerts its influence on other parts of us. Okay, so I'll give you all just a simple example of this. Let's say that I have my amygdala, which is experiencing fear or anxiety. But then what happens is this fear or anxiety feels overwhelming. So my brain, what it does is it essentially puts a wall around it and tries to block it off. So even though I don't feel the fear or anxiety, the amygdala is still connecting to other things. So it's connecting to my reticular activating system and interferes with sleep. So what will happen is that I'll have difficulty sleeping. I don't feel fearful. I don't feel anxious. But the amygdala is still like lit up. It's just I'm not aware of it. And then it'll also go to my frontal lobes and other parts of my brain, like my anterior cingulate and all these other parts of our brain. So let's say like our motivating circuitry. And even though I think I should do something, like I need to email my professor for an extension, I feel paralyzed. And where does that paralysis come from? That's because there is some fear or anxiety. My brain, another part of my brain, when I'm trying to act, right? So anytime I act, it's an integration of different circuits of my brain. Nucleus accumbens says something, anterior cingulate says something. My frontal lobes are planning out the tasks. My amygdala is warning me of danger. All of these different parts of the brain are like integrating and causing me to act. The problem is I don't understand that I'm afraid. I just avoid it and can't seem to bring myself to do it. And then if you tunnel down with people like this in psychotherapy, what you'll discover is that if someone is paralyzed or there's avoidant, there's oftentimes a dormant or illogical fear, right? Like you email the professor for an extension. Either they say yes or they say no. Delaying doesn't help at all. It doesn't do anything logically, but the amygdala is exerting itself on your brain. And it's like, no. They're going to think you're bad. They're going to think you're pathetic. You're going to feel like a loser. They're not going to write a letter of recommendation to you. It has all these worries which you suppress because you're playing video games all day, okay? So this is the basic problem with numbness, is that even though we don't feel it, it continues to act, exert its influence. So the reason that we numb ourselves is that if we don't numb ourselves, the distress that we experience is too much. So our brain can tolerate this level of distress, and we sort of see this in studies of trauma. That like once you hit this threshold, this is the threshold of dissociation, okay? And so like basically what happens is like up until this point, you know, we can feel this okay. And then we cross our dissociation threshold and then we can't feel this. But this stuff is still active.
If y'all want to dive deep into the most important topics for our community, check out HG Memberships.
So the first thing to understand is that there needs to be no outcome from small talk. This is a vasana too. Your mind is vasanas all the way down. So the key thing about detachment is not that you don't have wants. It is that your wants do not control you.
Membership grants you access to monthly streams as well as a back catalog of a year's worth of content, in addition to quests and so much more. If you're interested, you can sign up for $10 a month at healthygamer.gg/memberships or click the link in the description below. Hope to see you there.
So the first thing that we need to do to disarm our numbness. So we can talk about journaling. We can talk about all this kind of stuff, right? And you can do all that kind of stuff. But before we get to that, we have to understand the basic principle. So if we want to stop numbing ourselves, we have to understand what the numbing is for. The numbing is to protect ourselves. Protect ourselves from what? Pain. So one of the simplest ways that you can denumb yourself is your brain has to understand that the pain is not something to be avoided. Now, how can you help your brain understand that? Improve your distress tolerance. So this, I don't know if this kind of makes sense, but if my distress tolerance goes up, then my brain doesn't need to suppress as much stuff, right? So when I'm hypersensitive to pain, then I have to numb it out. But if I can tolerate pain, then I don't need to numb it out. And if you look at clinical evidence-based interventions, basically what we find is that one of the antidotes to numbness is distress tolerance. And we'll give you all a couple of basic examples. So the first is phobias. So when someone has a phobia, they avoid the thing. So what do we do to alleviate that need to avoid, right? So numbness is basically an internal form of avoidance. So does that make sense? right? Because my brain is like, we can't deal with this right now. So let's numb it out. Oh, I'm worried about my grades this semester. I'm worried about whether my boyfriend or girlfriend or non-binary partner is going to break up with me. So I'm going to just play video games and avoid the situation. So avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. So in the case of a phobia, it's localized to usually some kind of physical experience like enclosed spaces and claustrophobia or phobia for snakes. So what do we as therapists do to help someone overcome their phobia? We do exposure therapy. So we expose them to something and we increase their distress in a controlled environment. So when I'm working, my favorite example, because this like worked wonders and it blew my mind. So I was working with a patient who is claustrophobic. And what we do is like they're scared of riding on elevators. Okay, fair enough. So first thing that we're going to do is we're going to think about going on an elevator, but we're going to be sitting outside on a park bench. So this creates some sympathetic nervous system activation. Their heart rate increases. They start to sweat a little bit. We keep on thinking. They open their eyes. They realize they're safe. It kind of counterbalances. And then we elevate, right? So they're able to tolerate that distress. And then what we're going to do is we're going to watch people going on and off of the elevator. Now we're not sitting outside on a park bench. We are watching the elevator. This increases the stimulus. I feel more distressed, but then I'm able to tolerate that. Next thing we're going to do is I'm going to hold the door open. You're going to step into the elevator and then you're going to step out of the elevator. You're not going to ride it. We're just going to go in and out. And then we do that. Increase our distress tolerance. Then we're going to step into the elevator. We're going to wait 10 seconds. I'm going to hold the door open for you. And then you're going to step out. Then what we're going to do is we're going to let the doors close and you can hit the door open button whenever you want. So even when it gets halfway closed, they hit the door open button and it opens and they step out. So literally the way that we overcome this phobia, and then eventually you let the doors close. We're not going to hit any buttons. We're not going to go anywhere. Then we're going to ride the elevator one floor. Then we're going to go up and down a couple floors. Then we're going to ride a 60-story elevator. That's how we fix it. We improve the distress tolerance. So the other thing to understand is that this is also true of other clinical conditions. So borderline personality disorder is a great example of this, where a lot of the evidence-based treatment for borderline personality disorder is about improving distress tolerance. So people with BPD feel a lot of stuff on the inside. They also tend to do things like dissociate, have depersonalization. They just feel a lot, right? And BPD is associated with trauma. So we'll teach them certain techniques, grounding techniques in things like dialectical behavioral therapy that will improve their distress tolerance. And as they're able to tolerate the distress, you can open the doors and then there's an inferno on the other side and you can handle it. So the first thing that we want to do, if you are confused about what you want in life, you cannot avoid parts of yourself that are painful. And this is where a lot of people will say, do journaling. And that's fine. Like we can talk, we're going to talk about that in a second. But the main, I want y'all to understand journaling or doing therapy or whatever, what is the fundamental mechanism that is responsible for the change in journaling or therapy? It is the ability to tolerate distress. So when you're with a therapist, they hold some of that distress for you. They're sitting there tanking some of the damage with you, right? And then you break down and you cry and you feel a ton of emotions and they're there as a container. So we must increase our tolerance of distress. Because once your tolerance of distress increases, all of the stuff that is dormant and negative within you can start to come out. Then you can understand it. Then you vent some of that energy. So that'll help in and of itself. But then you can also understand where this negativity is coming from. You can understand this part of yourself that is insecure, and then you can focus on fixing it. So step number one is distress tolerance. Now, there are a couple of very simple ways to build your distress tolerance. So you can do this like physically, right? So cold showers are like a good example of something that you can do. But there's some studies that show that cold showers don't improve your willpower overall. The only thing they help you get better at is tolerating cold showers. There's some evidence that shows that it doesn't transfer. So another good supporting point for that is like a lot of people will think that like, oh, like doing these brain games will make you smarter. It turns out that doing brain games only makes you good at brain games. It doesn't like overall improve your IQ and things like that. There's some contrary evidence to that too, where some of these mental exercises are protective against things like dementia. But basically what's protective against dementia is learning something new, not doing something in particular. Okay. So what we really want to do is just practice discomfort. So this is where I'll give you all kind of a quick outline. Okay. So the first thing you can do is say hello. Just tolerate discomfort. Whatever your negativity is, tolerate some amount of that. So say hello to someone on the street. Give someone the bro nod. If you're a woman, I'm not sure exactly what to do. Maybe smile. I don't know. But that's scary, right? Because of people can interpret that the wrong way. That's what sometimes the advice breaks down. But I'd say hello is pretty safe, right? You can just say hello to someone. Another thing you can do is ask someone how they are, right? So like if you're in the elevator with someone, just say, hey, how are you today? Okay. Another thing that you can do, which is super scary, is compliment someone. Another thing that you can do is do something that induces some degree of discomfort. So good examples of this, for some people, it's like going to the gym. For some people, it's going to the beach. For some people, it is eating alone at a restaurant. So whatever it is that causes you discomfort, lean into that thing. Okay? Couple of other examples. So you can wear uncomfortable clothing. So I started doing this a couple years ago. I don't use roller bags at the airport. So it makes my life harder. I have to carry things and I have to like lug my luggage around and it induces some discomfort. But what we want to do is just practice inducing and tolerating discomfort. Now, once you do this kind of thing, you can also do other exercises that I really like. So now we can add some of these other things like journaling, going for a hike. I think spending time with yourself and removing indriya or sensory input from your mind will allow negative things to come up because they're kind of like, it's kind of like a zit. Right. So all this gunk is like pushed to the surface and you just need a tiny amount of like space to like let that there's pressure. There's already upward pressure. And if you're actively suppressing it, that's the only reason that it stays down there. So if you just give yourself space to not suppress it, it will come up on its own, which is a good thing. So when you journal, this is a I don't know if this makes sense, but don't journal about BS stuff. Journal about the stuff that matters. So this is really, really common when people journal is that they're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to journal about. Journal about what you don't want to journal about, right? Talk about your fears. Write down what you're afraid of. Like, confront some of those things. I really like hiking. So I think there's something really good about, you know, engaging your calf muscles. And calf muscles are basically, they're called the second heart in physiology because your calf muscles pump a lot of blood for you. So when you go for extended periods of walking, it does cool stuff to your brain. You're with yourself a lot. Negativity will start to come up and let it come up. Meditation is another good example of this, where when you meditate, sometimes negativity comes up and you just let it come up. Learn to tolerate discomfort. As you level up your ability to tolerate discomfort, you will not need to numb yourself. As you don't need to numb yourself, you will learn things about yourself. Okay? A couple of other tips for this. Generally speaking, the longer that we do something, the more stuff will come up. So if we look at clinical trials on meditation, what we tend to find is that people will practice for 20 to 30 minutes a day for at a minimum every other day, but oftentimes 5 times a week. And this yields a clinical benefit. So in my experience of meditation, the first half hour that you meditate is going to have a physiologic and psychological neuroscientific benefit. The second half hour that you meditate, you can meditate twice a day or you can meditate for an hour, is really where this stuff starts to happen. So it's kind of like the first half hour of meditation is to deal with the stresses of the last 24 hours. And the next 24 hours is the growth. So if you think about exercising, right? So let's say I'm lifting weights. I'm going to do 3 sets of 10. Where does the muscular growth happen? The first 15 reps that I do are not where the majority of the growth happens. It's the last 15 where the majority of the growth happens. Right, the first 7 reps that I do, it's not too much. The last 3 are hard, then the last 5 are hard, and then the last 6 are hard. So meditation is kind of the same way. Self-discovery is kind of the same way. It is in that end period that you get the most gain. So we want longer duration of hikes, longer duration of meditation, meditating twice a day, not just journaling for 30 minutes. 30 minutes I think is enough, but like journaling 30 minutes a day instead of 30 minutes every other day. So we want to really uncover that stuff and you need like more time for that, okay? Second thing that gets in the way of self-discovery is other people. So if we look at our mind, there are 2 things that populate the thoughts in our mind. One is ourselves, right? So we have things that are coming from within us. Here's our thought bubble. So like either these are my desires, my memories. And then the other place that things come from is outside of us. And what we tend to find is that self-discovery is very difficult when you are surrounded by other people that are inputting stuff into your head. So I work with so many people who are confused about what they want. And the more that I talk to these people, the more that I realize they're so confused. So what they do is they go looking for answers. They're like, I talk to this person. I watch this YouTube video. This person said this. My parents say this. And what I tend to find is that the more confused people are, the more inputs they've got. See, we have this idea that more information leads to better decisions, which is objectively true. But when you don't have an internal compass and your internal compass gets clouded by outside input, this becomes a huge problem. So we see this very commonly in things like peer pressure. I have a particular desire, but the people around me will push me in a particular direction. So if we're talking about self-discovery, it doesn't happen with other people. So there are some situations in which other people can facilitate self-discovery, but those people are often going to be people like coaches, therapists, or gurus, or friends, partners. But those people will be asking you about you. They're not going to try to feed you information or advice. So we see this as well. So if we kind of think about self-discovery is about a balance of internal info with external info. And when external info rises through the roof, the internal thing gets squashed. So we see this, for example, like evidence of this in body dysmorphia. So how do you feel about yourself? This is such a basic thing. Do I feel good about myself or do I feel bad about myself? And what we tend to find is that as you get more indriya or sensory input from places like social media, you feel worse about yourself. So I'll give you all a couple of like different examples, right? So we have studies that show that, let's take example number one, where my, let's say this is my self and this is my input. So in issue number one, or example number one, myself is, let's say, at a 50, and then I'm watching a lot of time on social media. This is like 100. So then I get body dysmorphia. Now, the other really interesting thing is that we can also have situations like this, where the self is at about a 20, and then the input is at about 50. And this will also be a problem. So a good example of something like this is borderline personality disorder. So this is where what happens is people have an unstable sense of self. And so what happens is that they get shaped and they get very easily shaped by their surroundings. So people with borderline personality disorder have a history of intense and unstable relationships because what happens is that they tend to fit themselves very perfectly to the mold of people around them. The problem is that since they're so malleable and so changeable, today I love beer and I love video games, but tomorrow I love punk rock and I love cosplaying, right? And when there's not a stable self, the self fluctuates and the people around you will kind of get confused. Okay. And we sort of see this a lot, right? Like where people are becoming more and more like the more of a chameleon you become, like the harder it is to discover your sense of self. And if we look at like what turns people into chameleons, it's external input. So we see this a lot in kind of like the alpha, beta, red pill kind of community where there are all these like dudes out there who are like, this is the way that I need to be. And women are like this and men are like this. We also see female versions of this as well, pink-pilled or whatever, right? So it's not like gender-specific. It's just the more that you get influenced by your surroundings, the less in touch with yourself you are. So the second thing that we can do is fix the balance between how much time we spend with ourselves and how much time we spend utilizing our sensory organs. This isn't just other people. This is social media as well. Because whether you like it or not, anytime you are on social media, your brain is going to be programmed. So a really simple example of this is that people on social media are pretty. And so if you think about the way that the human brain evolved hanging out with average people. And so you look at, let's say, the 100 people in your village, two of them are like a 10 out of 10. And the majority of us are like 5 out of 10, right? There's like a bell curve. Very few people are very ugly and very few people are very pretty. And the majority of us are just average looking. So when you look at yourself in the mirror, you see that most people look about as attractive as you. Now, the more hours that we spend at home with fewer average looking people and the more time we spend on social media, which selects for the prettiest of the pretty people, the more problems we're going to have with self-esteem and body dysmorphia. These have been studied where it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you believe about yourself. The increased minutes of exposure to social media leads to more concerns with your appearance because now your brain starts to think that normal is something else. So we see this not just with appearance. We see this with money and hustle culture and I'm so rich and I'm so successful. This is what we see. The more time we spend with this stuff, the worse we get. And then we get internally confused because we start to think I should be like this. So second obstacle to self-discovery is the externalization of our awareness. The more minutes your brain
is looking outside of you instead of inside of you, the worse off you'll be. So what we want to do, same answers as before. Spend time with yourself. Go for hikes. Don't even listen to podcasts. I guess music is okay. Spend time with yourself, right? So the most transformative periods in my life are, I wasn't transformed by other people. I was transformed by myself, by being with myself. So I recently took a 2.5-day trip. I extended it by 1 day just to spend some time with myself. And it's great. It's awesome. Strongly, strongly, strongly recommend it. So if you want to discover who you are, you need to spend time with you instead of externalizing your awareness. And I see this like this is why people will go to India to find themselves. Like, I don't know if y'all get this, but you're not in India. You're with you. Why do people have to go halfway across the world to find themselves? It's not that you're over there and you didn't realize that. That's the only way that you can get away from your sensory input. You have to get away from your job, get away from your family, get away from all of your externalizing attention. When you travel halfway across the world, you don't know anyone. You have no career over there. You have no goals. You're just there with yourself. You're carrying yourself with you. And so you're reducing your external input. That's the second obstacle. Stop externalizing your attention so much. A couple of other things. So once again, longer stretches are better. So I recognize that not everyone is capable of this, but y'all have to remember that my job is not to limit the answers to what people are capable of. Thankfully, we have people like Tech Teller and other awesome people in our community and on the HG side that are going to tailor things that y'all can access wherever you are. But generally speaking, length matters a lot. So 1 hour to yourself is a lot. 1 day to yourself is going to be even more. 1 week to yourself is going to be really awesome. 1 month to yourself is going to be really great. 3 months to yourself is going to be transformative. Beyond 3 months, I think there's diminishing returns. So I tend to find that in the people that I work with and in my own experience, like between 1 month and 3 months is usually pretty good. Like you don't really need more than 3 months. So if you can take an extended holiday or something like that, and even you can continue working and stuff, I think that's okay. But just spend a lot of time by yourself. For me, this happened very clearly when I first moved to Boston. I didn't know anyone. So at the very beginning, I was like, for a week or two, I was like, oh my God, I don't know anyone. So I went to a lot of different things and social events and tried to make a bunch of friends and made sure I got invited to various things. I went to go eat dim sum one day with like a group of people I'd never met before. And then at the end of that, I was like, wait, hold on a second. What am I doing? Like, I don't know anyone here. I'm not obligated to do anything. Like, I can just be by myself. Like, I don't need other people. And it was really great. So I spent several months just by myself, like in Boston, doing research and doing work and whatever. And it's really fantastic. So there's a really important principle to understand that your mind has different layers of stuff. Okay? So here's my mind. So if I have a sensory input, that will create a certain thought pattern, right? So if I smell someone cooking a hot dog outside, either I will say yum or I will say gross. So then what happens is in our mind, when we have a thought, we can then engage with the thought. So if then I get into, oh man, I really want to eat a hot dog, but eating a hot dog is unhealthy, I'm creating further fluctuations in the mind. Thoughts can engage with themselves. So if I'm not careful and I engage, I can start with a sensory input, but then I can engage with these thoughts and they'll just keep on creating more thoughts. So this is what happens like a panic attack where someone engages with their thoughts and one bad thought leads to another bad thought leads to another bad thought. So it's all operating over here. Now, if I reduce my sensory input and I stop engaging with my thoughts, and usually we can't engage with our thoughts forever, right? This is why 1 month is important. So the first thing that happens is my sensory input goes down. And then what happens is my mind will eventually run out of steam. If I don't feed it new stuff, it will get bored with these thought patterns. As it gets bored with these thought patterns, then this stuff starts to disappear. And then what happens is this other more dormant stuff will start to come up. But the problem is that this dormant stuff doesn't come up as long as we are doing this. And this is literally why we continue to engage in things like video games. Because in order to keep this from coming up, we will keep on giving ourselves sensory input, right? So we stay at the surface level of mind. So if y'all want to make the time that you spend with yourself more valuable, cut out sensory input, and then watch out for the engaged patterns of your mind, the habitual way of thinking, the vasana. Let it run out of steam.
Don't just run down that track. Don't even try to logically analyze it. Maybe you can kind of get to the bottom of it. You can do something like journal. But generally speaking, the goal is to run out of steam. So this is also why the process of meditation is so good at discovery. Because in meditation, we shut this off and we shut this off. So whatever is down there will start to come up. Okay, this is the general principle to keep in mind. So don't engage with your thoughts and don't get new thoughts from the outside world, and then you will discover. But since we keep on doing this and we keep on doing this, we don't end up discovering anything. We just get confused. The third obstacle we're going to talk about is judgment. So self-discovery is about discovery. It is about finding new things. So the next thing that really gets in the way of discovering something is judgment. So when you make a judgment, that is a conclusion. It closes off the exploration. So it's really fascinating. But one of my favorite classes that I ever took was a class. It was an upper level class, like a graduate level class, on Nobel Prize winning biology experiments. And the professor who taught the class was like, it was super cool what their thesis was. Their thesis was that people who win the Nobel Prize are people who are able to see things as they are. So the principles of biology and physiology are there. There isn't a creation of something new. There is a discovery of what already exists. It already exists. Y'all get that? They're not inventing anything. That's what I'm looking for. That's the word. They're not inventing, they're discovering. And so then the question becomes, okay, hold on a second. But if it's always there, if it's waiting to be discovered, why don't people discover it more easily? And the answer is their preconceived judgment. They believe they know how things work. So Nobel Prize winning experiments in biology are the ones that are able to revolutionize their judgment, their thinking, based on the data. Someone finds some kind of data that runs against the way that we conceptualize the world works. And then they win a Nobel Prize. Because we used to think the world worked this way. And then someone comes along and they look at the data which is sitting in front of them. And they're like, it doesn't work this way. It works this way. And then our whole understanding changes. This is discovery. The truth is there. What gets in the way is our preconceived notions. For example, when I work with people who are narcissistic and they say, oh my God, this person is discriminating against me. This person dislikes me. This person is so selfish. They make judgments about other people's behavior instead of understanding someone's behavior. They don't approach it with an open mind. And if you've worked with a narcissist, if you have a narcissist as a parent, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You got friends who are narcissistic. They jump to conclusions. You can also see this in online gaming. The reason that I lose is because my teammates suck. Jump to conclusion. Conclusion is the opposite of understanding. It is the closing off of the mind. It is not the opening of the mind. It is not reconsidering our data. And what you'll find, especially on the internet, is that more and more people are using their conclusions to shape the data instead of using the data to shape their conclusions. And what is the difference? It is the judgment in your mind. So part of the reason that we're a tiny slice famous on the internet, a little bit, we did one thing that is so simple. It's not anything grandiose. It's not even anything special, honestly. When we talk to someone on stream, we just do it with an open mind. That's it. That's it. And oh my God, this is so shocking and revolutionary. It's basic. It is the most basic thing. But we have forgotten how to do this basic thing. And because our stream is... So the fact that like people watch us and think that we do a great job at interviews... I do a great job at interviews, I guess, because other people don't interview people. I don't think I'm great. I think the rest of the world has forgotten this fundamental skill. And we see this in our community as well. It's like, it's beautiful what we see in our community. It's not just me, right? So I remember seeing a post a year and a half ago. I'm a conventionally attractive woman who can get laid whenever I want to, and I am incredibly lonely. And the community responded to this post so beautifully. In every other corner of the internet, this person would get tarred and feathered. You're so privileged, you're so privileged, you're so privileged, right? But like the people in our community were like, wow, like I'm a, you know, a 25-year-old incel. And like, I didn't realize that we like have shared experiences. Like this blew my mind. So in this community, we try to cultivate an openness. And the moment that you make a judgment, you close off the path of discovery because that's a conclusion. So really try to be non-judgmental, okay? So now the question becomes, how do we become non-judgmental? So a couple of things. We're going to understand the nature of judgment. So the first thing is, in your mind, you will notice that when you make a judgment, further thoughts don't happen. Oftentimes, you will find some kind of reaction with the judgment. Either some kind of emotional energy will be usually relieved by making the judgment. So I know this is getting a little bit abstract, but it's hard to really explain. So I'll give you all an example. So I was working with someone who grew up in a very religious background, who had a certain sexual preference, let's say. I mean, we don't call them preferences really, but they found themselves sexually attracted to something that they did not think was acceptable to be gender that they did not think was acceptable to be sexually attracted to. Okay. And so what they found is that they actually started judging very harshly. And like, if you kind of think about that example, as long as like I'm exploring this thing, it comes with a lot of fear. It comes with a lot of worry. It comes with a lot of panic. And then the moment that you judge it, that negativity goes away, right? There's a different kind of thing. There's like an anger that gets replaced with it. But like the moment that you judge, like it closes off some kind of painful experience. So another good example of this is like when we make judgments about other people. So like if I'm playing a video game and I'm like, my teammates suck, that is a judgment. What does this judgment absolve me of? It absolves me of looking at the fact that I suck. So judgments that we make to protect ourselves from negativity, that's what you want to look for. How do you know when you're making a judgment? If you remove that judgment, what are you left with? Because the mind is capable of judging. Judging isn't objectively bad in all circumstances. It's that sometimes judgment gets in the way of self-discovery and it closes us off. So pay attention to what your judgments do for you. When I make this judgment, how does it simplify my thinking? How does it simplify my life? What does it protect me from? If I think that poor people are lazy, that allows me a certain way of looking at the world. It absolves me of responsibility for making sacrifice to help another human being. Does that make sense? Because they're lazy, it's their fault. Therefore, it is their responsibility. I don't have to do anything. So you'll see this a lot where people are like very, very like, I'm doing good in the world, but they're not actually like, you know, they talk about doing good in the world, but they don't actually make sacrifices to help other people. And maybe I'm guilty of that too. Who knows? Right? I'm not saying I'm holier than thou there. I'm just saying that that's a pattern. So what y'all really want to look for is look for your judgments. And more specifically, what does your judgment protect you from? Oftentimes, judging another person harshly protects you from looking at yourself, accepting your own responsibility, looking at your own weaknesses, your own shortcomings. And like, this is what I'll tell y'all, like, it's awesome when you stop doing this for your life. It is so awesome. It is painful in the short term, but it improves your relationships drastically. Because now when you criticize someone else, you can own your own negativity. So I'm going to give you all, so I've gotten some feedback that y'all like when we talk about play-by-plays of social interactions. So if you are in a conflict with a friend, a parent, a partner, one of the best things that you can do is when you are criticizing them, own up to your own shortcomings. And you can say, hey, I know that we have a conflict. I'm frustrated by this thing that you do. I also recognize that this situation which frustrates me is partially my fault. I recognize that I do A, B, and C that contributes to this. I am guilty too. It takes two to tango. When you own that, it does a couple of really powerful things. The first thing is it starts helping you control your contribution. See, when we just blame the other person, when I think, oh, my teammates suck, I played perfectly, I'm never going to get better. The second thing that it does is it models to the other person, I'm not just blaming you, I am accepting some criticism, I'm happy to hear what you have to say. And I would even say, here's what I do to contribute to this problem, and I'm happy to hear if you think that there are other things that I'm doing that contribute to this problem. Here's what I've noticed, and please let me know if there's something else. Here's the concerns that I have, here's the criticism I have for you, you can even call it that. Here's what I think you're doing wrong, own it. And then own that you're not free of fault, unless you really think you are free of fault. So if you've done some kind of thing and you're like, hey, you keep on cheating on me and I've tried to give you chances and chances and chances, I don't think this is my fault anymore, right? So you can own that too, but then you should explicitly say that and go through the process. And even that is works really well. You can say, I tried to think through whether I drive you away. I tried to think through whether I'm not meeting your needs. I tried to think through, you know, whether I'm doing X, Y, or Z, and I really don't think that this is on me. I'm happy to hear if you disagree, but making me responsible for your behavior, I don't think is ever going to fix this problem, right? So you can own that if you're really not at fault. So, but generally speaking, the other nice thing is that when you open the door to criticizing yourself, you allow other people to follow your behavior. And then sometimes what can happen is people can like jump on that and they're refusing to look at their own part. And they'll jump on, they'll say, yeah, you do this and you do this and you do this, right? But that's exactly my point, is think about what we're talking about. We're talking about the relationship between self-discovery and judgment. And when that other person blames you and judges you over and over and over again, what does that do to their awareness of their own contribution? They have zero self-discovery, zero self-awareness, the more that they judge. And so we want to do the opposite. We want to judge less, or don't judge instinctively. Don't judge reactively. And the less we judge, the more we will discover, especially about myself. So oftentimes what gets in the way of our own discovery is self-judgment. And even that can be protective. Okay? So obstacle number one, distress tolerance and numbness. Obstacle number two, external input. And people are saying, well, how much external input is too much? And I'd say, if you want to discover more about yourself, input less things from outside of you. Okay? It's not about how much. It's not some minimum threshold. It's the more that you get external inputs, the more confused you're going to get about who you are. And then avoid reflexive judgment. So to conclude something after a stable process of thinking, that's fine. We're not saying that you should never make judgments and always be non-judgmental. No. Just avoid reflexive judgment. Because the reflexive judgment, and the key thing to think about is when judgment relieves internal tension. So when you make a judgment and it protects you against realizing something about yourself, well, that's why we do it, right? That's going to cause problems. Okay? Hey, y'all. Hope you enjoyed today's video. We talk about a bunch of topics like this on the channel, so be sure to subscribe for more. If you're already subscribed, GG, and we'll see you in chat.